Just want to provide a bit of context to what Kath was saying earlier, that we are starting a new series, and it's going to keep us busy up through the rest of July and through August. And we're going to be looking at what we refer to as the Ten Commandments, those words, those instructions that God gave to Moses to give to the people of Israel just after they'd come out of Egypt. Some words to live by. Some words to follow. And in our morning and evening services today, we're looking at what's been referred to as the first and the second greatest commandment, to love God and to love your neighbor. And in some ways, these are seen as a summary of those Ten Commandments that God gave. And we'll use them to provide a framework for the way in which we look at those ten over the next few weeks. And each week we'll look at, or each service, we'll look at one of the ten. And we'll look at the Exodus 20, which is where we get those given for the first time. And we'll think about what they said to the people then, how our understanding has changed over the years since they've been given, and what the New Testament has to say about them. How do we understand those in the context of who Jesus was and what he came to do and what he came to teach? And as we do that, we'll be able to think about some broad questions. What do they mean? What impact should they have on how we live today? Are they commands that were given to a different people, a different race, a different culture, thousands of years ago, that have no relevance for us today at all? Are they commandments that have as much force for us today as they did for the people of Israel when they were given? How do we understand and interpret them in the light of who Jesus is and what Jesus has done? And many of us will have different views about those questions. Some of us might never have really thought about how we should understand or engage with them. Some may have very clearly worked out ideas. And so it's good to have an opportunity to explore them together and to see how through them God calls us to live distinctive lives, lives that are aligned with his will and purposes for us, instead of lives that are aligned to the demands and the expectations of the society that we find ourselves in. On the face of it, the question asked by the legal expert in the story that Carl read to us was a perfect opportunity for Jesus. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? It's as though someone was coming to him and looking for Jesus' opinion about what was important. How did he understand the law that they all sought to live by? What was the key thing that Jesus wanted people to know and to understand? Sometimes we do get nice questions that give us an opportunity to explain things that we think are important. A few weeks ago, we hosted a visit from some year one children from the school across the way. And we'd explicitly been asked to speak to them about worship. What does it mean and why do we do it? It was a good question. A great opportunity to share with them about how worthy our God is and to encourage them to appreciate him for themselves. But sometimes there are loaded questions. But the purpose is less to get information, but it's more to trip people up and get them to say things that will end up being embarrassing or worse. We see that particularly with politicians, as they're asked difficult questions that are designed to expose gaps in their policies or issues in how they're behaving. And it can happen for a number of reasons. One of those reasons is when a group of people don't like you. They feel threatened by you. They're trying to drag you down. And this, I would suggest, is the context in which this man came to Jesus and asked him what sounded like a nice question. Because by this point in his ministry. Jesus was not popular with the religious authorities, the people who said, this is how we should obey God, this is how we should live our lives. And if you, the passage that Carl read was from Matthew chapter 22. If you take the time to read through even just Matthew 21 and Matthew 22 up to this point, we'll see how over the last few days, they'd had a few goes. They had a few disagreements. The religious leaders had seen the amazing things, the wonderful things that Jesus was doing and how people were getting excited about that. And they were indignant. They were starting to follow him as opposed to following them. They didn't like it. They came to him and questioned his authority. On what basis do you do these things? He, in turn, challenged them about not living up to their responsibilities. And so they thought, we'll just arrest him. We'll get rid of him. He suggested that they might even be excluded from God's kingdom. These were the people that everybody else looked up to in terms of religious thinking, of living. And Jesus said, actually, the way you're going about it, the way you're failing in your responsibilities means that you might be excluded from what God is doing. And they tried to trap him. They tried to trick him into saying something that could incriminate him. And so he turns to them and points out the fact that they just don't even understand the Bible, the scriptures that they were expected to live by. This had happened in just the last couple of days. They were not good friends at this time. And so in that context, this bright young man, an expert in the law, comes to Jesus with a question. Not because he wanted to know Jesus' opinion, but that hopefully he could find something wrong, maybe something heretical in what Jesus said. But the answer that Jesus gives is a perfect textbook response that they could both agree on. It was based on their shared common understanding of the ancient law that God had given to his people. He's quoting it. He's summarizing it. And he starts, as Kath reminded us earlier, he starts by drawing attention to God and saying that the first thing, the most important thing, is to love God. And that would have been totally familiar to the people around him. Those words that Mark read from Deuteronomy chapter 6, which concluded with those words, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." Jesus, along with every other faithful, observing Jew, certainly male Jews, because it was very much a patriarchal society, they would have recited those words twice a day as a reminder of their dependence on God and their allegiance to God. And so these words that Jesus speaks would not have caused disagreements, but Jesus, I suggest, invests them with some special meaning. And he starts with these five words: love the Lord your God. There's a recognition of authority. The Lord, the Master, the King. This same title had been applied to God in the Old Testament. And it draws together many different aspects of our understanding of the supremacy of God. It reminds us of his power in and over creation. It reminds us of the mighty acts that he performed through history and in the history of God's people. It reminds us of his absolute reign over the universe. And it challenges individuals as to how they relate to this person. Are they willing to fully accept him as Lord, as King, as the one with authority over their lives? Or do they wish to retain this control for themselves and seek to engage with God on their own terms? And implicit in Jesus using these words as a challenge to the person that he was speaking to and the people that had sent him and saying, are you prepared, are you willing to recognize God as supreme? Some people want to engage with God in a way that is nice for them, a way that is helpful for them, where God is there to call on when things are difficult, when God is there to blame when things go wrong, as opposed to saying, actually, he is Lord. This call from Jesus does not allow that. It calls on people to recognize the authority of God. It calls on people to recognize the authority of God, not just over the universe, but over their lives as well. It recognizes that this person is God, not just a God, not just the God, but your God. There's an intimacy in relationship. In some wonderful, deep way, people are drawn into relationship with the infinite, eternal, incomprehensible God and are welcomed into his presence as they recognize his deep care and commitment to them. In those verses that Kath read, right at the beginning of our time together, we find God saying to the people, I am the Lord your God. He had rescued them. He had set them free. They were his people. He was committing himself to them as their God. And that was something that people continued to recognize right up until the time of Jesus, that God was in a particular relationship with them. God had stayed faithful to them. He was their God. He was Lord, but he was there for them. He was their God. It gave them confidence. It gave them security. It gave them a sense of being loved and being watched over. As they looked back on the history of God's dealing with them and seeing how God had been there for them, how God had loved them, how God had guided them, how God had cared for them. And there's a call to respond to this God, to this Lord, in total love. That's what Jesus is saying. Love the Lord your God. If this is the person with whom we are in relationship, the one who is totally sovereign, the one who's the God who has committed himself to us, how are we to respond to him? And there are many answers to this. We are called to recognize his holiness. We are called to serve him. We are called to seek to know his will for our lives. And all these and many more are important. But here, in many ways, summing up everything else, is the call to love. To reflect his nature of unfailing love in how we respond to him. In the words that Carl read, we find Jesus calling on us to love God with all our heart and soul and mind. In the words that Mark read, we find heart, soul, and strength. There is a different emphasis. But fundamentally, they're saying the same thing. In Deuteronomy, the word heart was used to refer to people's thoughts, intentions, feelings. Maybe slightly differently to how we think of it in this context today, but that's how it was used then. This is, you know, what they thought about, what they focused on, but also what they felt. And soul was related to that, but it's more about emotions and passions, the things that excite us, the things that motivate us, what gets us out of bed in the morning. If we go through the Old Testament, we see this call a number of times, love the Lord your God. Mostly we just see us being encouraged to love God with heart and soul. But here, this first time it's mentioned, we get this idea of strength, to give extra emphasis. All that we are, all the power, all the might, all the ability that we have is to be focused on this. To love God with everything we think, everything we plan to do, and for that love to fuel our passions and to guide our desires, to hold nothing back. When Jesus speaks about mind, he's talking about, you know, applying our intelligence, our understanding to that. For those interested, if you look in Mark's gospel, we get all four: soul, mind, strength, heart. They're all included. But the point in both places is to call on the people of God to love God totally and completely, with every part of their being, holding absolutely nothing back. Just over 5 weeks ago, our youngest son, David, got married to Natalie, and it was a great day. Everything seemed to work well, and we got to that point in the proceedings where the bridegroom stands up and does a speech. And he does the things, he did the things that bridegrooms are expected to do, and he thanked all the people who'd done various things, and it was well done. And at the end of that speech, he turned to Natalie, who was sitting next to him, and he said this: "After coming to know God, you are the best thing that has ever happened to me, and my promise to you is very simple. I will spend the rest of my life trying to love you in the way that you deserve." It was a powerful moment. There were a few tissues reached for. And I'm sure it meant a lot to Natalie. And this is the idea behind how we are called to love God. However we understand what heart and soul and mind mean, the call is to love God with everything that we are, for him to be the focus of what we do. And for Natalie to know that David loves her, she'll need to see that promise worked out in action. And it's the same in our relationship with God. It's not just about what we feel. It's not just about what we think. It's not just about what we say. It's not just about what we do. It's about all of those things and more. Trying to accomplish great things for God without being motivated by love, Paul tells us, is of no value and achieves nothing. But deep feelings of love that don't result in any action have no impact and make no impression on the people or situations around us. The feeling and the action need to come together. Even though we have here the call of Jesus to love God, even though he, as a pious, observing Jew, would have recited these words daily, there is only one occasion in the Gospels where we read of Jesus directly speaking of his love for his Father. It's in John 14. And Jesus is speaking about, he's talking about the prince of this world, he's talking about the devil coming to take him away, so he's going to be crucified. And he says this: "He comes so that the world may learn that I love the Father and do exactly what my Father has commanded me." Speaking about the time he was going to die on the cross. And saying that this powerfully sacrificial act was the supreme moment when he would demonstrate how much he loved his Father, how much he was willing to commit all that he was to loving God, the one who had sent him. All through his life, Jesus demonstrated his love for God. But it was on the cross that this was demonstrated most completely, where the challenge of those words was lived out to the full, where Jesus went to the extreme of what God had sent him to do. And Jesus was able to say, it's in that that everybody will recognize, will know how much I love the Father. It involves action. One of the interesting things is that at the time of Jesus, this call to love God was accepted. It was the heart of how the people lived and worked as a community. We can see that, however, many times in their history, they failed to live up to that. They knew that was what they were supposed to do, but they kept on messing it up. But it was expected of them. This command to love God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength was enshrined in their law. It was central to who they were to be. For us, it is so different. The expectations of society, the subtle or or not so subtle messages of the media, the advertisements we see, the continuing growth of materialism and consumerism, all conspire against us to encourage us to relegate God to the edges of our lives, even if he's able to get a look in there. We're expected to order our lives so that we will be happy and fulfilled. We're continually told that for this to happen, we need more and more stuff. We elevate others to the place that God should have in our lives. And this is not to say that we shouldn't be happy. It's not to say that God doesn't want us to be happy. But so often the priorities that we have in our lives make it impossible to love God in the way Jesus is calling for here. And the pressures to conform to this are all around us. We see TV programs, we listen to radio programs where the name and the person of God is mocked. It goes on around us, in our neighborhoods, in our schools, in our workplaces, in our coffee shops. Do we go along with that? Or are we offended by it? I was listening to Roger Federer this week, a short interview he did, and he was thinking about how he grew up to, you know, want to be a tennis player. And in that, he referred to Pete Sampras as his idol. We know what he means, that he was the person he looked up to. But how many of us elevate specific people to idol status? And how much does this displace God from the center of our affections? We commit time and energy and skill to many things, to our work, to our families, to our hobbies. And these are all good and important parts of who we are as human beings. But do they sometimes get in the way of loving God with every aspect of who we are? Or do we find it possible for God to be at the center of those things as well? To love God in the way Jesus speaks about is not just about a feeling, maybe not even primarily about a feeling, but it's about action. It is about what we say. It is about what we do. It is about the priorities we determine for our lives. How much does our love for God affect what we do each day and how we do it? If we didn't have that love for God, would it change what people see about how we spend our time, about what we do? How much does our love for God affect our daily lives? How much does our love for God affect how we engage with others, each one of whom is made in the image of God? We'll think further about that this evening as we think about what God's call to love our neighbour as ourselves. How much does our love of God influence our long-term goals and plans? When we, maybe sometimes we sit down and think, what do I want to be doing in 5 years' time? And how much does the thought of God and what he wants and how we can demonstrate our love for him factor into those deliberations? How much are we willing for our love of God to cause us to say no to other things, even things that are perfectly fine in themselves, if they're getting in the way of our relationship with God and living for him? If David's commitment to Natalie is carried out, it will affect everything he does in his relationship with her. How much more should it affect our relationship with God and how we choose to live as a consequence of that? To love often is a choice. Sometimes we might not feel like it. Sometimes it's easy to do. Sometimes we need to decide to do it. My encouragement to all of us here this morning is to hear the words of Jesus and to commit, recommit ourselves to seeking to live them out daily in our lives. To love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. Not keeping anything back but saying, but thinking, but doing in a way that demonstrates we love God.